Our next guest is one of the most powerful women in real estate. Marianne Gilmartin has shaped the New York City skyline, although at first blush, you might think she's an unlikely real estate mogul. Born in Queens, married to a retired New York City police detective, she's brokered the deals that have brought about the New York Times skyscraper, designed by Renzo Piano, the wavy-edged New York by Geary, one of the tallest apartment buildings in the world, and the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, which was the first sports arena built in New York City since 1968. For the latest in our conversations with global leaders, let's get the view from the top of the real estate world with Marianne Gilmartin, president and CEO of Forest City Ratner's Companies. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. You know, if I may start with something perhaps a little cheeky. When people think of the phrase big-time New York City developer, I'm not sure that the person that pops into mind is someone like you. I mean, namely, first of all, you're a woman. Has that ever been an issue at the table?
Well, I would agree that a nice Irish Catholic girl from Queens is not what comes to mind when you think of a real estate mogul in New York City. So I like to think that it happened in part through pure serendipity. I was given a fellowship to come into New York City government under Mayor Koch, and I thought I would try real estate on a whim, really, because I had two fellowships. And so I spent the summer dabbling in large-scale public development, and I realized at that moment I had real estate in my veins.
How did you know that it was real estate? What happened around that moment?
It was the sheer excitement of realizing that at the time, at 20 years of age, you'd be sitting in a room talking about what should happen to the west side of Manhattan, and you're feeling at once overwhelmed and then completely blessed that you could be with incredible minds, both inside of government and outside of government, recreating the city, changing the ground plane, and contributing in a great way. I never got that memo that said, you know, women need not apply, this will be really hard for you, you won't garner the respect of the white male community in New York that really runs the business. And that's really because Bruce Ratner, the chairman of the company here, runs a meritocracy.
Well, let me ask you a little bit more about that, because I take your point that that may be the culture inside the company, but, you know, the definition of a job of a real estate developer means you're working, you know, with dozens of other individuals, other companies, contractors, planners, city officials, et cetera. You can't tell me that it's never been an issue, you being a woman, that you never had any rough patches there with people responding to you as a woman or the most powerful woman at the table.
So in the beginning, I would often look up and realize that if 25 people were sitting around a table, I would be, you know, one of one. And I don't remember being intimidated, but I also know that I'm a decent collaborator. So when I wasn't in charge, I think I just wanted to always be at the table and participate in a meaningful way. Did I remember having setbacks because I was a woman? I think that as a principal, I knew I needed to be a principal, and part of that's my control issues. But, you know, when you're a principal, when you control the pocketbook, when you control the decision making, when the buck stops here, in many ways, people conform. People step into line. You know, they may be talking about me behind my back, but I think part of what you realize when you get to a certain place in an organization, if you have the backing of the organization and they believe in you, then people really fall into line. And I think that's another important thing for women to remember. And I think in different fields, it's quite different. So if you're in a law firm where you're booking hours and you're trying to raise a family and you want to be home at dinner time, you know, I always say I do my best work after 11. I would put my productivity beside any male peer during my childbearing years because I was super, super focused. I was organized. I was motivated. But I was also serious about being a mom.
You said you'd put your productivity up against any one of your male colleagues. But given the fact of all the stuff that you were doing at home as well, makes it sound like if you took an honest assessment of your entire life, you were being even more productive. I mean, workaholic virtually sounds like it.
I think that I used to say the sleep is overrated. My husband stays home. He's a retired professional and for sure one of my secret weapons. But it doesn't change what one wants to be as a mother and the way that we all have to reconcile that tension between being a professional and being, you know, being a parent. I have this feeling that I've been able to do it in a way that I'm proud, and it's super inclusive. inclusive of my children. So when you build things, what's the greatest thing about that? There's a lot of really great things about my career, but I have a physical, concrete representation of my toiling, right? So I can take my children up on a hoist. I can bring them to the top of a building. I can bring them down in the hole. I can mark every milestone event of every building I've built with where my children were in their developmental stages.
You know, I suppose this is a point in time where listeners are saying, you're talking to one of the most successful real estate developers in New York, and you haven't yet talked about any of her projects. So can we talk about the New York Times building for a moment? Designed by Renzo Piano. You've called it your breakthrough project, and why?
So, you know, no parent has a favorite child, but I would say there's a very special story around that building for me. And I want to start by saying if any developer can build three great buildings in a career, you've like hit the career lottery. And for me, having built the New York Times building, New York by Geary, and Barclays Center, that is a trifecta of extraordinary proportions. But it does begin with the New York Times building in a sense, because that was a project where we were the dark horse, you know, the Brooklyn developers that nobody thought would had a shot at building for the great gray lady. And so setting about competing for that business, Bruce Ratner said to me, "We're not going to win and you're wasting your time." And I said, "Well, I just have a feeling about this one and I would like your support to pursue it." And I think that Bruce Ratner believed it was an object lesson for me in my career development to learn how to lose. And of course, my highly competitive way and my not accepting the fact that I would lose led to ultimate victory on Valentine's Day of the year 2000. And it was extraordinarily complicated. It was the Uber example of ground up development in the great city of New York.
Yeah. You know, you said the complexity of your business. I mean, it's also, let's face it, it's controversial. I mean, the surrounding residential and commercial development around the Barclays Center, called Pacific Park, for example, I mean, there have been lawsuits over that. Critics and community leaders have objected to land seizures, use of public money to build the projects. I guess my question for you is, you know, sort of circles back to where we started, that when people think of big-time New York real estate developers, maybe what they think of is, you know, the 1%, people who are rich enough to sort of sweep aside the interests and lives of others in, you know, in pursuit of these multi-million or hundreds of millions of dollars of projects. I mean, what do you tell people who believe that that's what developers do?
It's a really interesting topic. You know, I always laugh when I come to know someone, you know, community-based, a minister from Brooklyn, activists in the community. When you spend time with those people, you know, one of the greatest moments is when you realize that they themselves have recognized that you don't eat your young. You know, that you care about the very same things that they care about, and we don't have to agree on everything. But it's this recognition that this is a calling of some sort, and it needs to be something you believe deeply in, because it is going to be high pressure, high risk, complicated, and difficult, because that kind of tension, it's always a characteristic of any project, but certainly Pacific Park Brooklyn became sort of the poster child for that type of tension. But today, what's happened with the project, I believe, is that the arena, having been open since September 28th, 2012, has proven to be a very good neighbor. It is a place where there are 2,000 workers, 80% of those workers come from Brooklyn, a third of those workers come from public housing.
You know, I'm really curious about your perspective on the bigger issue of gentrification in cities like New York, because the New York City Housing and Vacancy Survey recently found that only 3 neighborhoods in the whole city haven't yet been gentrified. That's like one of the main issues that cities are facing today. Who are they for? Who should they be for? Who will they be for if places all across a place like New York or any other city in America or around the world are becoming totally unaffordable for average residents?
I think that gentrification is the number one consideration and challenge for any city that undertaking large-scale development projects and thriving, you know, based on an economic boom. Because certainly, you know, you can push the folks that can't afford it out to the outer rings of all these cities. You could push them into suburbia and have people live in Yonkers. But that's not a successful city. What makes a city successful is the diversity of its people in and around the urban core. And so I believe that affordable housing needs to get accomplished in the large-scale development format. I don't know if you know this, but luxury rental housing in New York City for decades has been built with 80% market and 20% low income. Now, those numbers are now going to edge up to 30% under the de Blasio administration. On top of that, with density as a tool, this administration is committed to creating more new affordable housing. Now, can it be eradicated? Can the housing crisis in New York City be entirely eradicated? I don't think so. But let's remember, if we start building office buildings, the people that are going to work in those office buildings are the low-skilled, you know, middle-skilled workers, as well as the high-paid worker. The city has to be healthy, and we have to be creating jobs so that they can, in fact, you know, earn a living and have a high quality of life here in New York City. And it's very complicated.
So, Marianne Gilmartin, hearing all that you just laid out to me just now, I'm suddenly wondering when you're going to run for mayor.
Well, that's very kind of you, but I wouldn't be mad enough to do that. I really do believe I have the best job under the sun, because I just am able to work and operate in so many different aspects of city living, and I love our city.
Well, Marianne Gilmartin is president and CEO of Forest City Ratner Companies. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure for me, too. Thank you.